This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project. Today is October 17th, 2005. This is a continuation of the oral history interview with Professor Joe Elder of the Department of Languages and Cultures of Asia. Joe, we want to pick up the interview today with a review of your many grants that you've held in the course of your career, and ask you to comment on the significance of them for your work at the university.
The first series of grants I became involved in had to do with finding support for the study abroad program in India. It is expensive to travel to India, and we wanted to keep the program as competitive as possible, in fact keep it even more than that, so people could go with very little money. The fact that there were these rupees stacked up in the American Embassy in India meant that there was a sort of easy money if you could frame the thing right.
Yeah.
And so the first series of grants that went in would end up with the rupees being given, and then we had to pick them up at the American Embassy and spend them entirely in India and keep separate books. This money came from the rupees, and this money came from the University of Wisconsin. So the poor graduate students who were handling those things became experts at what double bookkeeping or whatever is involved there. And that continued, and still continues, the eagerness to supplement funding so the students can go to India without it being a terribly expensive project is something that I continue. In the next several weeks I'll be putting in a proposal again.
Oh.
And it's the Office of Education. There's a Fulbright Fulbright program under it, which encourages exchange programs. And there's a particular seminar and study abroad component there, which we are quite competitive at, and which we keep going back, and they keep giving us money. So that's almost an annual event, so no need for that. The bigger money began with the film project, where once again the fact that there was lots of money in rupees meant that I could get fairly substantial chunks of money to handle the films in India. When I look back at some of the figures that came through there, I was by the time you take $100,000 and convert them to rupees, you have lots and lots of money.
Yeah.
But that meant that we could have teams stay over there for long periods of time. When I began dealing later with professional filmmakers, I realized how lucky we were to have two things. One, ample money in India, and the other, the kind of dedicated camera and director people who would be perfectly happy to live in a village for 4 or 5 months in order to get the pace right and so on. When we worked with BBC at one point, we had to shoot an entire film in 5 days. Otherwise, if it was 6 days, they had to bring in, they had to fly in their camera people and sound people from Britain, and the price would go right off the top.
Yes.
So shooting a documentary film in 5 days compared to shooting a documentary film in 9 months is all the difference in the world in terms of what one gets out. So that was the second series of grants in their whole series, the Smithsonian. Typically the rupees would come through the Smithsonian, but then the money would be sitting in the embassy, so we'd be authorized by that. When I became president of the American Institute for Indian Studies, then I was in the heavy grant process, because it was the institute that would apply for funding the National Science Foundation, Natural Endowment of the Humanities, the Smithsonian, you name it, we were there in our begging bowl, in order to fund major offices in India and then provide scholarships for PhD candidates and senior scholars. So much of the time when I was president, I was simply filling out these forms and sending them in. Luckily, we had staff people who were very good in this kind of thing. Otherwise, I would have been doomed. And at a certain point, you get kind of a format, you know, what's expected. But still, it was a case of the deadlines hitting you always a little bit before you were fully prepared. And government deadlines are deadlines. You don't get it in on time, and it's...
There's no maneuverability.
You're back in the queue someplace for next year. So it was a bit of a task. But anyway, that was where, during the period I was president, it looks like all I'm doing is earning money from various people. But they were set up. As one goes through it, it's for fellowships, it's for the management of the American Institute for Indian Studies. It's a whole series of things, each of which went into this major research center. And I must say that the AIIS is something, I think, of a model research institution. The fact that it's being run now by about 50 colleges and universities that share in the directorship, they send people to the board of trustees, and that we have a single entity that asks for money, and that screens all the candidates for senior fellowships and for PhD candidates. So there's no competition between institutions. And I think we get the very best people as a result.
Huh.
So that's sort of the short story of a lot of filing of applications. And at the moment, once again, it's mostly back into funding for the study abroad program that I'm submitting proposals.
And was there much private grant money for the study abroad program?
The Mellon Foundation, we did get a little bit of money from the Ford Foundation at one point for one of our films that worked out fairly well. We went to the Mellon Foundation for a particular fund we were trying to get going. For a number of decades, actually, we had been the center for the study of Tibetan Buddhism in the United States. I may have mentioned that we were the first place, and maybe the only place, to have a PhD program in Buddhist studies.
You did mention that.
And one of our major assets was Geshe Sopa himself, a Tibetan monk who helped give the final exam to the Dalai Lama. So I can only say, well, I know people who are smarter than the Dalai Lama because he gave the exam to the Dalai Lama. But anyway, as he was retiring, we thought maybe there'd be enough of a clientele out there so that we could get an endowed chair. And we did approach the Mellon Foundation because they had indicated an interest in something like this. They did come through with the money. It wasn't a whole lot, but it was something. And once you have something, the plan was to have it matched. And here, there was a miscommunication between me and the development people, because I had sort of assumed that they would be the ones who would hustle the match. They knew who gives money and so on. And at that point, they weren't as efficient as they now are. So it languished. I was thinking they were doing something, they were assuming I was doing something, and then all of a sudden we were getting threats saying, like, if there isn't matching money, we're not very interested in giving the money in the first place.
I see. Oh, from Mellon.
From Mellon, right. Was it the understanding that they would give some and we would give some.
This was a time period for this, Joe?
As I look at the grant, it's in the 2000s. It was Geshe Sopa retired, I think, around 2000. And so this was at that same particular time. So in the end, we kind of bumbled through. The total amount we got from the Mellon Trust account was $13,000. We weren't able to match it, and so it ended up being just a very small sum of money which we used to help a little bit with libraries and round out student fellowships and things like that. Since then, I've seen the development people become very, very good at something like that. They know who might give and who might not, and they're much smoother. But at that point, we were all learning how this thing went. And I guess, also, they're not always dealing with people who are intrigued by Tibetan Buddhism. They're dealing with people who are in biochemistry and a number of other fields where there are more better funded interests than this one.
But it would seem to me that there has to be a growing interest in Asia generally.
Right.
And that the prospects of raising money to support study abroad and your other projects, it would seem to me, would be brighter than it was, say, 20 years ago.
I think that's true. And actually, the Office of International Studies and Programs has set up a Joe Elder Scholarship Fund.
Oh, great.
People have kicked in money specifically to go for students studying abroad. And one of our alumni from the Nepal program gave a fairly generous grant to do this for 3 years. So the last 3 years, we picked 10 students going to anywhere in the world through the Wisconsin program. And they've gotten supplementary money to help them with travel.
Oh,
so that's kind of a nice thing.
That's great. And now you've become an icon.
There we are. Okay. Right. And there was a little ceremony last, you know, when you meet the students who are about to go. And last year, I was on the selection committee. And there are, you know, very, very good students. You try to pick the ones for whom $2,000-$3,000 might make the difference between being able to go or not go. That's what you're sort of looking for.
What's your assessment of the future availability of grant money from the Office of Education?
The very fact that there are things like terrorism around help us. The first funding from the government came because of Sputnik, and suddenly there was vast amounts of money. The center started here and played a key part in many of our lives. We never wanted to point out that studying Telugu didn't seem to beat the Russians somehow, but if they were giving us money, so we're supposed to study international languages, that's fine. And now there's a new spurt after 9/11. There's been an eagerness to have people learn the languages, the Pashto and Farsi and various Tajik and languages that are spoken in that area.
So yes.
There's money that's become available, and it's hard to find students who want to go in and study it because it's such a small market when you're all through. But I think one reason we're able to have our summer language program comes almost directly from that, that suddenly money was available to increase the study of languages in Asia, generally in South Asia in particular. So it sounds kind of grim, so long as there's a fear of people in that part of the world doing dangerous things, we may be doing okay as far as money's concerned.
That is odd, isn't it?
It is odd.
Joe, I don't cast judgment, but you really, one wants to pursue knowledge because it's good for the human condition.
Exactly. There was something of a crisis after Sputnik because the money was being given under something called the National Defense Education Act.
Right.
And for a period of time, the people who were issuing the money required a loyalty oath to receive the money.
Really?
And you can imagine how that went over.
Yes.
So there were people who would receive it and then be told, but you have to sign that you've never been a communist. And so they wouldn't take the money. And gradually, we were able to bring pressure on the Washington people saying this is serving no useful purpose and it's hurting some people who, on grounds of conscience, don't feel like they could do this sort of thing. But that's always been a tussle between money from Washington. This sees this as defense, and those of us who see it as a great way to explore the culture of the world, and they aren't always synonymous with each other.
Interesting. Anything else on grants that we should note here?
That's probably, and I went through the way the American Institute was able to take money and get it turned into an endowment. That probably is the most significant thing as far as the survival of the AIIS was concerned.
Joe, let me
say a little bit about my wife.
Oh.
She was the undergraduate advisor in sociology for years and years, and there's a small scholarship in her name. So we actually have a Joanne Elder Scholarship Fund and the Joe Elder Travel Fund, which are not terribly funded yet. We haven't managed to write huge checks, but I'm not sure how many couples there are in the United, on the campus that have won. This is to go to undergraduates who are financially...
So you and your wife worked together in sociology for years.
Right. Well, we were in the same office. She was, I was on the faculty, and she was academic staff. And I maintain that she had much more glory and status than I did. She had a much bigger office. She had a private secretary, so I couldn't get in to see her without being cleared by the gate watcher. For years, she had a view of the lake. I had a view of Observatory Drive. She sort of helped create a job when Russ Middleton was chair of the department. He was the one that renegotiated the hours we taught so that we could move upward. And he also saw the need for undergraduates to have serious advice. In the old days, the notion was, well, give 15 students to a faculty member and they'll advise people. Well, we faculty are really bad advisors. We don't know the rules. We have no idea if the course in Spanish literature in Platteville would match the course. You know, we'd just be bad.
Uh-huh.
But the thesis was students should work with faculty. And it took my wife and several other people a bit of an effort to say, this is a serious job. It requires people with other talents who focus entirely on advising. And beginning in the mid-60s and on now, the major departments have undergraduate advisors who do this job full-time. And I'm pleased, my wife feels she contributed to a new idea. Now I think unless a faculty member wants to volunteer to be an advisor, we're not doing it well. The other thing she came up with was seeing the need for a place where students who weren't clear about their majors could go. She would deal with sociology majors. And the undergraduate advisor in psychology would deal with them, and somebody in history. What about a sophomore who just doesn't know what to do? So she and a few others came up with the idea of the cross-campus advising center, where there would be a place where an undergraduate could walk in and say, you know, maybe engineering, maybe medicine, maybe business, maybe philosophy, I don't know what, and be advised how to place themselves in position. And that is one of the inventions that she and a few others contributed. And the other thing she contributed, the time had come to get academic staff in the university governance. You know, initially it was the administrators and the faculty, and then students were brought on. But for a long time, there's this vast series of administrative staff people who don't have any voice. They just come and do work. So she and several others organized the academic staff committee, which eventually became an organization. And now people in academic staff will elect representatives, And this meets as kind of a legislative, like the faculty senate. And on virtually every university committee, you now have faculty, students, and academic staff sent by this academic staff council. And that was something that she played a key part in organizing and getting going.
But that's quite a structural reform, isn't it?
That and the cross-campus advising. And the fact that both of them have flourished. You know, it took a certain amount of people harumphing and saying, I'm not sure academic staff should be involved in critical decisions. You know, all the kind of reasons people give for not having other people come in. But I think it's comfortably settled now. So
it's interesting to me. I did not know this. It's interesting to me, though, how many faculty that I interview speak quite highly of their various department secretaries.
Oh, absolutely.
How much many of these, mostly women, mm-hmm. I think, know.
Yeah.
And how much they contribute, actually, to the substantial work of the department.
Mm-hmm. They become the memory. They're often the human face. If you get a good secretary or assistant director, you've got a real gem.
So they are members of the academic staff, I take it.
There's a clerical division, and I can't always sort out who they are. They're civil servants.
Uh-huh.
But then they're the academic staff, and these are often, you know, soft money, or they don't get tenure positions, they get rolling horizon positions and so on. But they're on the campus, and many of them live entire careers on campus. So giving them a voice was something for which the time had come, and it's here.
Actually, I was going to ask you about your wife because Dean Joan Reduca had said to me,
uh-huh.
be sure you ask Joe
right.
about his wife.
Uh-huh.
I believe she said something like, she is at least as significant as he
I would
is.
Say she is at least as significant as I am. And in terms of institutional change, if you look at both of those, you know, those are long-lasting structural mm-hmm. features which she and a number of her close friends and the academic staff were able to put in.
Now, is she still working for
She retired. She retired about 10 years ago.
Oh.
And that was kind of funny because she had a male secretary at the time of her 65th birthday. And he was great with computers. So when she came in, there was this huge computer sign, Happy 65th Birthday, Joanne Elder. And people began to ask her if she was going to retire. And when she went in the morning, she had not thought of retiring. And by the end of the day, she couldn't think of a good reason not to retire. So she planned a splendid retirement party next March. It was first in row, you know, by the time you get in April and May, there are many retirements. So she timed it so there were deans and chairs of departments and alumni. It was a wonderful event overlooking Lake Mendota. And then even then, she retired from the sociology department. And before long, she was hired back by the history department because they were missing an advisor for a semester. And then she retired from that, and then she was hired to be the director of the cross-campus advising center because somebody left and they needed somebody. So I kept maintaining she just liked retirement parties. So for several years she would, you know, be off and then back on, always very sheepishly explaining, Joe, this is only temporary, but I'm getting another job back at the university. But that finally ended, and then what she did, she ran for school board, and she was elected on the Madison school board and served a term there. So. She is active in many ways.
Yes, I remember when she was on the school board. I was sorry she didn't run again.
Right.
I think she chose not to run again.
She chose not to. She, again, the funny thing, how people see her, she was interviewed by a reporter after she got on the school board. Her major reason was that she was concerned about diversity, LGBT issues.
Uh-huh.
And the person, there was a key vote there that was quite obstructive on things like that. And so Joe ran against this person and won, so this person was off, and now the majority was interested in maybe even having a staff person who would work on LGBT issues in
uh-huh.
public schools and libraries and all that. So she got that, and then when this reporter asked her why she was doing this, she explained she was concerned about diversity in the schools. And then she talked about all her other interests, which were mostly international, and at the end of the interview, the reporter says, I don't see why you're in school board. Your interests really are international. And at that point, she thought, you know, you're right. So she put in her time. She learned a lot. She saw a lot of Madison. It's not just one night a week. You're two or three nights. You're off at the Hispanic place and the Allied Drive neighborhood, and you're meeting this group and that group. But she did feel that her interests really weren't in this. And the vote having gone the way it did, she felt that she'd done whatever needed to be done. So she announced a year before she was due to retire that she was retiring so other candidates could get along.
I remember when she retired, I was sorry because mm-hmm. she was a progressive voice on the school board. Joe, can you talk about the presence of the Dalai Lama on campus?
Sure.
How you arranged that, when it was. It was major.
Right. The first time he came, the main reason he comes, I think, is Geshe Sobo. The Dalai Lama has a personal fondness for Geshe Sobo. And if you stand over in Dharamsala in India, look at where Tibetan studies are growing and flourishing, Madison, Wisconsin stands out. There are other places, but Madison is there. So the first time he came was 1981, and Geshe had invited him to engage in a Kalachakra ceremony, which is a ritual in which people can be initiated at various levels of involvement in the Sangha, the community. I was identified as a link between the university and Geshe Sopa and the Dalai Lama's office because I was in the department. And one of the, initially it was just, when is the Dalai Lama coming? Could there be dormitory reserved? What would be involved in security? All these kinds of things. Among other things along the line was the need for security, since the Dalai Lama is both the head of the state and a religious figure.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess nationally, there is an obligation to provide him with extra security, including, we discovered, the need to have an armed guard within a few yards of him at all times, and instant telephone communication, so if anything happens. Well, I learned to my great relief that the university routinely provides that, that every police car has a weapon in it, and every policeman, most policemen, have some easy way of communicating, so it wasn't as serious as that. The embarrassing moment came when, after the dates had been set up, I was informed that the Dalai Lama's astrologer had recalculated the appropriate date, and it was now going to be a month later than the one that they'd scheduled for.
Oh my.
And I had to go and explain to the university administration. I couldn't say the astrologer refigured it. So I just said there had been a change in plans, and we were not so far locked into it at that point. Another humorous thing was that Dalai Lama had to speak from a throne, and Buildings and Grounds doesn't have thrones. We had to come up with something that would look like a throne, which one has in a Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist teaching institution, where the teacher does sit in a much more impressive chair than all the others. But we overcame those particular kinds of things.
Where did you find a throne?
Somewhere in probably the costumes. I'm not sure anyway, they found something. And it went very, very well. There was because he was coming, I think that was one where they built a special, for months they began to build a special temple out there in Deer Park, so there'd be a place where he could come and have the initiation ceremony and all the rest. I happened to be out of the country in China the weeks he was here on a trip that I planned a long time before, but came back and had one of the most enjoyable slideshows I've ever seen, because there were a lot of people who had not been able to be there, including, I think, the chancellor and several other people. So the Buddhist community had a slideshow for all of us who were interested, and this included the policemen's wives, and some of us who'd missed things, and a few Buddhists who hadn't seen what had happened. And it was out there at Deer Park, and here were these pictures of sort of like the family show. Here's the Dalai Lama doing this, and periodically, so there's my husband, Oh, that's my son showing the Dalai Lama. So that was the first visit, and then subsequently there were a series of visits at different times. The most important of which, I guess, was when he actually received his honorary degree, and I don't have that date at my fingertips. But the honorary degree committee sort of asked if this was something we could put together, because he achieved a lot of prominence. He won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Right.
And this was a short while after that. So it was not hard to put together a proposal. And the fact that Wisconsin was a leading place for teaching Tibetan meant that there was kind of a justification for that. Because anybody who gets an honorary degree is supposed to have some link with the university. And the fact that by then he visited several times also meant that we could legitimately claim that he was a badger and therefore could get an honorary degree. And to be a little bit sort of entertaining, the degree was given in the Cole Center, which had just recently opened up.
Uh-huh.
And the Dalai Lama was perfectly fine in speaking in English. But to add a little touch to it, he spoke in Tibetan, and then the graduate student translated for the crowd what he was saying. People, wow, now I know what Tibetan sounds like, which was, you know, kind of fun.
What does it sound like?
It's a Tibeto-Burman language. There are a few slight tones. It is not Chinese. It's not the heavily toned sound. And for some reason, I've heard more Tibetan chants than anything else. And those tend to be very, very musical in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
They'll recite something with a very low voice. In fact, among other things, there are Tibetan chanters who can literally produce four different tones from the throat at the same time. Yeah. One of our students mastered that. He was on the year in Nepal program, came back, and illustrated something, which I guess all of us could do if we practice it, where he would introduce one tone, and then another one, another one, and then move one of them around, so you have four different tones coming out, one of which is in motion. Now, I can't imitate it, obviously, but anyway, chanting and Tibetan have been in hand and glove for a long time.
Wow.
So that was kind of a nice touch.
Yeah, absolutely. What's he like?
Very impressive. What? It's his manner, I think, that impresses people so much. When you look at what he says, if you or I said it, people would say, well, that's obvious. But for somebody in that position to say it, who represents kind of a mysterious tradition,
mm-hmm.
who's dedicated his life to his people, who's committed to nonviolence, who has been sort of like a Gandhi in terms of world prominence, and who speaks very comfortably with people of all faiths, a sense that he may be a Tibetan Buddhist, but he speaks of spirituality in such a way that, and he says, whether you're Muslim or Hindu or Catholic or Protestant, we're talking to each other on a level which transcends all of that, which is sort of a Buddhist level. It has to do with the mind and the state of the mind. So he's just very appealing in his willingness to appear with people and in multi-religious ceremonies, completely at home with a rabbi saying something, or completely at home with somebody singing a gospel hymn. He's there and is absorbing it and kind of expressing joy with the whole thing.
Joe, he is still unable to return to Tibet.
Is that right? That's right, yeah.
Do you foresee that ever changing?
The last couple of years, there have been some indication that things might change. Now, this used to be a Joe Elder, who's an eternal optimist, so he has to be kept very careful here. China has made a long... The Chinese position on Tibet is that this was a miserable, religiously dominated, tyrannical, feudal estate, with monasteries fighting against each other, with peasants desperately poor, taking the growing crops of the monasteries and so on. So the standard person in China reading about Tibet feels that it was very, very backward, dominated by a theocracy, with the elite not doing much of anything, and the peasants not having any prosperity because everything they produce goes into the monastery. And the Dalai Lama is pictured as a pretty selfish person who enjoys the power. I think the fact that the issue has been raised again and again, and where the Chinese are in touch with the world, they are aware that their policy toward the Dalai Lama backfires again and again.
Mm-hmm.
That at some point, where they are trying to win recognition of the world as a civilized nation, it may be one of those bargaining chips where they would be willing at a certain point to say, okay, bygones are bygones. They've done some pretty devastating things to Tibet.
Mm-hmm.
Most devastating being moving in lots and lots of Chinese. So a Tibetan is almost out of touch with the culture and the language that's being spoken in Lhasa. And that the Tibetans mourn because it is an occupied country for practical purposes. But still, there might at some point be an acknowledgement that things are going to change a fair amount. But with China changing as it is, and with the middle class coming up, and with people in touch with the rest of the world, and a sense of human rights and so on, it just might happen that there will be some symbolic return where, within an arena of religious communication, he could come back with a clear indication he's not, in any sense, a secular ruler, but if he wants to be there for those who observe that particular form of religion, it might be possible. It's a bit of a stretch, but it's not impossible.
Yeah. I'm just interested. You know, right. I haven't read an assessment of that lately. When was the last time he was here?
He was here 2 weeks ago. I was at a service with him in Riverside Church about 2 weeks ago. He was here to, when he comes, there are dozens of things to do. But among other things, Riverside Union Theological Seminary is opening up more study of non-Abrahamic faiths. And they wanted to have a major ceremony in which he would come and begin fundraising and so on. So as a member of the International Interfaith Peace Council, as a trustee, I was one of those that helped set up the meeting and then set up the worship service that was there. And then he met with us for an afternoon. He is a member of the Peace Council. He's kind of the inspiration of it, as a matter of fact. So he also...
This is side two of tape number 6 of the continuing oral history interview with Professor Joe Elder.
There's the Tibetan office in New York City, and you approach them and they decide how much time is available and who's there. Furthermore, especially in New York, the security was immense. The Riverside Church, where the service was to be held at 5, was sealed off from 9 in the morning on, with police cars at the various intersections, a sweep of the whole place to make sure nobody was there, sniffing dogs to make sure there was no powder or explosive anywhere. How can you be a normal person when that's the way in which you have to live? So the meeting that we had with him, I felt, was quite stiff. There were sort of too many people there. There were probably a half dozen security people standing around, and it wasn't quite a chat over a cup of tea that we were. He was good. He was helpful. He was articulate, but it was stiff. It wasn't a meeting with him as a member of the council. He was the person in the council was sort of addressing him, and then he was addressing the council.
Do you have yourself pretty good access to him? If you decided, for instance, that you needed to get in to see him about a project that was significant, could you?
I would work through people I know who could do it. I'd do it that way, right. Now, I'm sure if I picked up the phone and said, Your Holiness, this is Joe, I don't think I'd get anywhere. But if I would approach Daniel Gomez Ibanez, who is the executive director of the International Interfaith Peace Council, Daniel knows him, and Daniel has his phone number in Dharamsala. And Daniel was the one that, in a sense, over the years, has been the contact between us here in Madison and the Dalai Lama.
That's quite significant.
It is.
I think. Mm-hmm. You've had really an extraordinary life.
And not particularly planned that way.
Joe, I'd like to switch at this point to your role, both community service and as a citizen of the United States, and as a member of the Quaker religion, took quite a prominent role that you had in peace efforts during the war in Vietnam. If you would talk about what you did and the significance of those efforts.
Okay. The peace activism of the Quakers began with the trip to India and Pakistan. I think that's on the file somewhere. And once you've done that, then you sort of are on the bench for other things that may happen. That first trip was January of 66. Then, let's see, the Vietnam War was beginning to get pretty bad by around then. For the summer of 69, I had volunteered to work for the American Friends Service Committee anywhere that might be useful. They had become concerned about the fact that almost all of their projects are ex post facto. Something happens and then you respond, something happens. So at this point they decided that they were trying to take some kind of initiative, because the war in Vietnam was going to end at some point. And what could be done by Quakers who would be meaningful in a situation that was so badly shredded by the war. So the plan was that I would spend a couple of months, probably in Bangkok, looking at what was called the Mekong River Project. The Mekong River flows through Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and branches, I guess, are in Thailand as well. And there actually was a consortium of countries that included the communists and the non-communists, all of whom saw it to the advantage of developing the Mekong River because it's so basic to this area. So my thought, and the Quaker thought was, well, there's some way in which we could plug into this, because they actually have conferences where for the day they stop killing each other, and they have the North Vietnamese, the South Vietnamese, the Pathet Lao, and the Royal Lao, and the Marxist Lao meeting. I watched this happen once, and the war is crazy, and non-war is equally crazy. We have these people come on a truce day and talk about what they might do with the Mekong River. The meeting that I watched was one where a couple of Japanese engineers had been, they weren't killed, but they were threatened, and they said they were going to withdraw from the project unless all the sides agreed that they were not going to be attacked. So here all sides were meeting. This was in Vientiane in Laos. They had this meeting in a hotel. But they all said, okay, we're going to tell our boys, back off. You know, the Japanese are doing important stuff. Well, that plan was put into effect only up to the point where I was with four other Quakers in Stockholm, sort of on my way to Thailand. The North Vietnamese had called for a conference of people who were peace activists, and the Quakers were peace activists. We were actually the largest American delegation in Stockholm. We met, therefore, with the head of the North Vietnamese delegation, whose name was Madam Binh, who was quite a figure.
I remember.
And at lunch, she was talking with the executive secretary of the American Friends Service Committee. The Quaker position, typically when a war breaks out, is our insignia service for civilians on all sides, because they tend to be the ones who are victims with the least care. So when the Vietnam War broke out, we had set up a hospital in South Vietnam that was very, very busy. We worked with amputees and burn victims. We were able to get some supplies to the Viet Cong, but that was difficult because they were underground in tunnels and things. But we'd also wanted to get something to the North Vietnamese, and they had consistently said it's too dangerous to come in. The principle is somebody goes and meets people and sees what's going to happen, and then whatever is sent is provided for. There's a monitoring, so one knows that it's actually being put to use at the end, and it's not being used for military purposes, it's used for civilian. Well, Madam Binh at this lunch said that she had been considering the Quaker request to come periodically. Can't we send somebody in? Can't we send somebody in? And she said, it's okay, we now could send somebody. So the secretary of the American Service Committee puts his hand on my shoulder and says, well, here's the person we're going to send. So at lunchtime, my assignment was transferred from sitting in Bangkok looking at the Mekong River to being a link between the Quakers in Philadelphia and the North Vietnamese government.
And the university was supportive of your...
They were mercilessly... They never interfered as far as I knew.
Oh.
Now, I think they caught some flack at some point. In fact, I imagine they did. And I will forever be grateful that I never heard any voice of criticism from any administrator. Mm. And I'm very grateful for whoever didn't pass it on, because I'm sure they were getting flack, because here's a faculty member aiding and abetting the enemy and what could be worse and all the rest. So I spent most of the next month, partly in Paris, partly in Phnom Penh in Cambodia, where there were embassies of the Viet Cong and of the North Vietnamese. Uh-huh. Got my visa, which was really complicated. Managed to fly in on one of those neutral flights. After the fall of Dien Bien Phu and the truce arrangement, there was a plan so that every week, either once or twice, a plane flew from Saigon to Phnom Penh to Vientiane to Hanoi and back, because there was a inspection commission of Indians, Poles, and who were supposed to make sure the ceasefire was maintained. Well, by now, ceasefire was out the window, but this group is still monitoring, presumably, the peace treaty, the Geneva Accords after the fall of Dien Bien Phu. So that was the only way one could get in both directions. You go fly to Hanoi from Saigon. So I got in. Spent a week in Hanoi, was met by something called the Vietnamese Committee, the American Vietnamese American Peace Committee.
And this was 69?
This was May, June of 69, yeah, right. Actually, June of 69. Let me back up a little tiny bit, because the American Friends Service Committee had been concerned about the Vietnam War, and when Richard Nixon was elected president, in the process, he maintained that he wanted peace, and his mother had been a Quaker.
Yes.
So we used that leverage, and we wrote to him saying, that maybe there'd be something useful the Quakers could say to him. Could we meet with him? He replied that he couldn't, but we could meet with Henry Kissinger if we wanted to. So a meeting was set up with about six or seven of us from the American Friends Service Committee in the basement of the White House with Henry Kissinger to talk about our concerns for the war. This was a strange meeting because we were protesting the war outside in front of the White House, and then we were invited in. And the first thing that Henry Kissinger said, is this off the record or on the record? And we weren't quite sure how to answer that. He said, well, if it's off the record, I can say things that I'm not free to say otherwise. If it's on the record, you can read what I say because it's all in the papers. So we had to make a decision fairly quickly of were we going to listen to him and then go out and say we can't say what we were told, or we were going to hear what was said all the time. So we opted for off the record.
Uh-huh.
He then told us in sort of veiled terms that there was a peace plan underway that he was quite sure would be successful. In fact, at one point he said, if we don't have peace in Vietnam by December, I give the Quakers permission to come back and tear down the gates of the White House. Now this is May, okay, of 69. The war went on to 75, so you get some sense of where people thought things were going. The reason I was on the committee was because I was going to go out and be in Bangkok looking at the future. Also, I guess at that time I was the board of directors of the AFSC. Anyway, I had some sort of position there. Well, the idea was that we had this meeting in May. We would meet again in July, 2 months. And by then I would come back and report, and there were some people who were going to work with the Vietnamese in Paris and report. In other words, there'd be a second meeting with Henry Kissinger after a couple of months had passed. So now I wasn't going to Bangkok, I was going into Hanoi, so this was even sort of more interesting. When I was in Hanoi, along with getting a list of what they wanted us to buy with our $35,000 of money that were raised mostly from Canadian and American Quakers for civilian war relief. And since it was Canadian money now, I didn't run into the same problem I would have if it had been U.S. money, which would have been impossible to transfer.
Mm-hmm.
They ended up giving me a list of open-heart surgical equipment that they wanted us to use the money for, which was puzzling because it didn't strike me that was the highest thing on the list. The whole week, I was trying to figure out what they wanted me to come back in with, and school supplies were mentioned, and sort of basic health stuff was mentioned. But the day I was to leave, there was a typewritten list in French with the numbers from catalogs as to which they wanted sphygmometers and catheters and valves and all sorts of things to use this money up for. So I came back to the States. On the way, I circled around and visited South Vietnam and was at the hospital I'll be running there for burn victims and amputees. And I'm probably one of the few people who was in Hanoi 1 week and Saigon the next week in a situation where that doesn't happen very often.
Yes, indeed.
Once back in the States, my job was to, and their purchase agents who bought these equipment, so allowed them to go back into Hanoi as soon as I had everything all together. So we did meet with Henry Kissinger in July. There were several messages that the North Vietnamese had asked me to convey to him. They were curious. He was still sort of officially, he wasn't Secretary of State yet. He was
National Security?
Officer, whatever, yeah. So they said, we're curious whether who is making decisions right now in the United States? Is it the head of the State Department, Henry Kissinger, or is it Richard Nixon? Are they serious? I mean, are they really wanting to settle things? Because we realize that publicly you have to say certain things, but you may be privately interested in a serious negotiation. And if they are interested in a serious negotiation, we would like them to give us a quiet signal, because then we'll know that the discussions going on in Paris are real.
Uh-huh.
If they're not, and we all have pretenses, it's your politics. But if they are serious, ask them to close down Operation Phoenix for 2 months. If that shuts down, then we'll...
Was that the bombing?
Operation Phoenix was assassination of civilians.
Oh, okay.
So we were doing the assassinating of civilians that we saw on their side.
Okay.
So that was the message, the essence of the message that I came back with. And there was a great deal of interest in the fact that I'd been actually to Hanoi to come on back, and a lot of curiosity of what Hanoi was like. And when I laid out this suggestion that if it's serious, then shut down Operation Phoenix for 2 months, Henry Kissinger said, "What's Operation Phoenix?" And at that point, I didn't know how to take that, because the Wall Street Journal had articles on Operation Phoenix. It was, you know, a very ugly assassination process. And Henry Kissinger said something about, "You may be surprised that we don't know everything about the war," but that seemed like it was kind of an important enough part of the war. So he said to one of his aides, "Find out what Operation Phoenix is and let me know." Was this charades? I have no idea what was going on. But anyway, the message was conveyed that this was one of the terms. When I went back in August to take the supplies in, I also had 2 bags full of letters from the relatives of servicemen who had been shot down, because the North Vietnamese had not given the names of any of the men shot down. Their statement being, the war had never been declared, these weren't prisoners of war, they were criminals, and they deserved no better treatment than criminals. So their names were being withheld. I met with relatives who didn't know whether the men in their lives were alive or dead or injured or what have you. And we did announce that if people wanted, I was going back in, and if I could carry something, I'd be happy to see if I could deliver it. But one of the things I tried to do when I was there was either meet with American prisoners of war or exchange stuff with them. So when I went in the second time, I had these bags. Three times I tried to get in, but the plane would take off and get about halfway from Vientiane to Hanoi and then turn around and come back. And there'd be some explanation that it was rainy, it was a monsoon or something like that. And then each time I had to get a separate visa and a new ticket, so I was running through money pretty fast on this thing. And the third time, the North Vietnamese embassy in Vientiane said, "Could you do something for about a month someplace else?" And I said, "Well, sure. I can go back to school, but could I try maybe in a couple of weeks?" They said, "Well, okay, why don't you come back in a couple of weeks?" So I flew to India, visited the Wisconsin programs that were just getting started, came back, and at the Bangkok airport, the mystery was resolved. There in the newspaper was a big picture of Ho Chi Minh and the announcement Ho Chi Minh had died. What had been happening was they knew he was going to die. They knew that there would be huge state funerals. The Chinese were going to come separately from the Soviets, because at that point they were very hostile to each other. And to have one Quaker bopping around with a bunch of open heart surgical stuff was just not
high on their list.
That's right. So at that point, I signed a condolence thing to the embassy. Sorry that you're going to die. I said, just let me know when to come back. Now, I'm going to go back and teach. I may not be the Quaker who returns. I would certainly love to come back, but other people could do it. That was end of August, I guess. About October 1st, the message came through that things had cleared, there'd been big funerals and all that. And they were ready now to have a Quaker come. And I guess they either asked for me to come, or the office thought it'd be nice for me to come because I had the contacts. So I pulled myself out of class for a week, went back to Vientiane, picked up all the stuff I left in the garage, flew into Hanoi, delivered the stuff to the research hospital, found out why they wanted this, because it didn't seem as though it would be high on priority list. And did they have surgeons who knew how to handle the stuff? Yes, there was a big oxygenator which they borrowed from the French. Yes, there were staff who'd done this kind of thing. And the purpose seemed to be that in a lot of developing countries there's something called rheumatic fever. It hits young people and their hearts are scarred and they're more or less invalided for the rest of their lives. Huh. If you take the scarred valve out and put in a mechanical valve, they're 90-95% healthy again. So that seemed to be the target population, young people who have been crippled by this, who would then become fully participants. So anyway, there were photographs taken, and I got whatever data I needed to get to come back out and make the case that this wasn't just a game they were playing. They were being hammered from the air, and they said, "Oh yeah, we could use smoke in our equipment. We're not being hurt by what's going on." So I came back out, and when the plane landed in Vientiane, I was met by 3 quite different people, each representing a different interest. I'd been in touch with every American embassy as I went in. So they knew who I was. I met the ambassador and told what the project was. The ambassador to Laos was very hopeful that I might have a list of prisoners, because if I had that and he released it, it would be a wonderful feather in his cap.
Wow.
He also was very skeptical about whether this was all a charade, that the North Vietnamese didn't know how to use this kind of stuff. So he was eager to see any photographs that I might have. Then there were two young Frenchmen who believed North Vietnam was the paradise, and they wanted me to sit down and tell them how wonderful North Vietnam is. And then there was a Washington Post stringer who wanted to talk to me about how I found out. So here were these three very separate audiences waiting to sort of do whatever, you know, find out what had happened. And I did turn over all the stuff I had to the embassy.
Uh-huh.
They were particularly, they were skeptical. They thought this was, the wool was being pulled over our eyes. So the next day, they sent the photographs back to me, and I had a picture of the equipment that they'd been using prior to the equipment that I brought in. And I had said something like, this was French equipment from, you know, 1965 or something like that. And the guy said, actually, this is from 1964. So it wasn't, there was no doubt that they had the right equipment, but the date was a little bit off. I didn't have a list of prisoners, which would have been very nice for the ambassador. About 6 or 8 months later, they did release the names of the prisoners. I'd had a long talk with them about their position. I said, you know, I can understand you're wanting to make the point that this isn't a war that's been declared and that people are in their homes being bombed from the air and so on. But it's more difficult for us who are sympathetic with you to make the case that there should be some sort of peaceful negotiation when people look and interpret this as a kind of barbarism and heartlessness. Because the families, it makes a huge difference if the man in the family is dead or alive, just simple information. Now, whether that ultimately contributed to their decision, I don't know, but I think several people were going. Jane Fonda was in there at some point. But anyway, they did finally release a list of names.
You did not meet with any of the POWs, I take it.
Didn't meet them.
Would they deliver your letters?
Some of them got through. I met at least one person who got a letter that I'd carried in years later. It was pretty interesting, that the whole business of, you know, how do you deal with men who've been shot down bombing the area in which you're living. But people, from that was a very touchy issue here in the States, because there was a feeling that it just showed how barbaric the North Vietnamese were to know that these men were alive and not that their families know about it.
Did you? Your file in Bascom shows quite a bit of press related to all your travels to North Vietnam. Were you briefly a national figure in the popular press? You were talking to the Washington Post. Were you talking to the New York Times? And
there was one press conference I held in Washington, which was interesting. This was when I come back the second time. Ho Chi Minh had died, and there was a lot of curiosity of what was going on there. And there were a number of senators and congressmen there.
Uh-huh.
And it was the first time I had sort of watched how this happened. The senior senator is one who opens the press conference and the one who closes the press conference. And I was sitting there with a number of Quakers who have their offices in Washington, the so-called Friends Committee on National Legislation, which knows these people. And they had set up the press conference. And it was basically, you know, on one hand, there was this notion of how totally naive anybody would be to go in recognizing that what you would be seeing would be carefully doctored, and what they didn't want you to see, you wouldn't be able to see. On the other hand, there was this great curiosity about prisoners and, you know, what one actually could see.
Mm-hmm.
So it was probably as much to, you know, in the evening news. it was hardly bigger news than that, because there were important figures like Jane Fonda who were much better publicized than anything I did. And I certainly was not eager for publicity, because it would rebound negatively as much as possible.
Did you have to testify in Congress?
Never did. No. Uh-huh. Just the press conference was the closest thing I ever had.
So I feel like I should ask you, you were there in North Vietnam in 1969, and then the Sterling Hall bombing happened here in 1970.
Right.
What was your reaction to that?
I was appalled by what happened there. I was very active in Vietnam War. I think I mentioned we had this thing called Faculty for Peace. We had a radio program Tuesday nights with call in, and just constant rallies and protests and one thing or another. The concern was that many of the people that would appear in the protests were pretty violent. You'd be alongside people who'd be shouting for victory for the Viet Cong and stuff like that, which wasn't quite where I was. But when you're protesting a war, you're sort of protesting with anybody who's beside you. The trashing was, I was always sad to see that kind of thing happen. But the series of events following the invasion of Cambodia, which was, I think, early May of
1970.
That was a bleak moment for me, because I had actually been in Cambodia the year before, in Phnom Penh. And I'd been flown to a place called the Parrot's Beak with an Australian Quaker senator who's been shown by the Cambodians what defoliation did to rubber plantation. And it was ghastly. We saw a rubber plantation as it should be, and then a rubber plantation where American defoliants had blown in over the border or been dropped over the border. It's hard to tell. And they were dead. There were no leaves on the trees and all the rest. And to watch Richard Nixon point to the map at the Parrot's Peak and say, "Tonight I've ordered the invasion of our troops into Cambodia because it's harboring the Ho Chi Minh Trail," and so I just felt really sick, because I envisioned these villages with thatched huts and bamboo sides, and what happens when serious artillery barrage comes out on them. That was followed by very, very strenuous criticism of what happened. And that was followed by the Jackson State killings, and then by the Kent State killing. And the campus just came apart.
Mm-hmm.
It was compounding that was a teacher, a student strike, like for the TA strike. Everything went down the tube.
Uh-huh.
So classes weren't meeting, there were protests, trashing in the evenings, all the rest.
Were you canceling your classes, or were you still teaching?
I went to class because there were foreign students who couldn't not go to class. So what I did, I prepared lecture notes which were available to hand out to students who didn't want to cross picket lines, and then I talked to the Koreans and Malaysians and so on who were there.
Uh-huh.
So kind of double duty. Faculty did all kinds of things. Some would be off campus in church basements and one sort of another. But it was a huge relief to have the year end and the instructions come down from the chancellor's office. Just figure out some way to give grades and turn in your grade list, and let's just call it quits. So that was the way the school year died in May, June. And then the services continued. The Army Math Research Center was clearly a target. We left that day for a family reunion in Estes Park in Colorado. And we heard about the bombing of Sterling Hall on the radio.
Oh, you weren't here.
Try to figure out if we might have known anybody who was involved in that, because we had known some students who were pretty committed to the notion that nothing but some terrible event will catch anybody's attention. So when we came back, it was very much the aftermath of the bombing of Sterling Hall.
Uh-huh.
Subsequently, actually, I knew the widow of the man who was killed. She was in one of my classes.
Oh.
And then subsequently met their kids, so that part of it was also part of the real world. And then subsequently met the people who did the bombing. That's sort of the way Madison is.
It's interesting about Quakers. You're really opposed to violence on all sides.
Right. Which makes it easier or harder, depending on how you look at it.
Yes.
But it was a ghastly thing. I could understand their feeling. Well, we're somebody has to make it clear to people in America how horrible this is. I'm convinced they didn't want to kill the grad student. In fact, it looked like they did everything to avoid it. But when you walk through a place like Tan Hoa in North Vietnam and realize that it's just been bombed to the point that there's nothing standing. And somehow, the cruelty that's being inflicted there doesn't register back here.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who dropped the bombs were up at 35,000 feet and had no sense of the carnage that they engaged in. You wonder, how do you connect the awful things that are being done by nice people? And the bombing of Sterling Hall, although it had a negative reaction, did sort of bring the point home. This is really, really ugly. You blow up buildings, you kill people.
Joe, have you been back to Vietnam?
Yes.
When was that, and how was it?
About 4 years ago. Since then, this is another sort of interesting story. Once you've been in Vietnam, I think you never can quite get it out of your system, especially because it was such a prominent part of so many years on the campus. But in about 1990, we met a veteran of the Vietnam War, Mike Bain. And Mike had served two terms in Vietnam. He had been completely debilitated by it. He said he spent the next 20 years hugging a toilet, vomiting and drinking and drugs and all that. And then he'd gone back to Vietnam with a group of veterans and built a clinic. And that started a healing process in Mike. And to make a long story short, eventually he and our Quaker meeting had lined up to have what's called Quaker and Madison Quakers, Inc. And he is our link with Vietnam. He's dedicated himself to doing good things. There are two peace parks that he's helped build. There's the school, series of schools we're building in My Lai where the massacre occurred. And now there are dozens, if not hundreds, of microloans that are being functioned by Madison Quakers, Inc. and Mike Bain, and this odd alliance between a veteran and the Quaker, small Quaker group.
Oh, interesting.
And I think it was 4 years, 3.5 years ago, that several of us decided that we would be in My Lai on the whatever 26th anniversary or whatever it was of the massacre. Because each year on the day of the massacre was a big ceremony. So we were there, and there's laid a wreath in memory of all those who lost their lives. And the two helicopter people who played.